This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Classified information as distinguished from the information that Bradley Manning revealed, much of it which was not, in fact, classified. And we are going to welcome Jeffrey Clements today on Who Owns the Government. This is the ultimate voice on corporate personhood, and no doubt that voice will find echoes in some of the words of previous guest on the show, Catherine Austin Fitz, who spoke at length and in depth on the global face of the global face of corporatization, in other words, the corporate ruling class that is gradually becoming the face of our government. And those are the headlines. First, though, this from the National Weather Service. We've got the cloudy skies starting up today, obviously, gradually burning off, and a high eventually around 70, light variable winds tonight. More clouds moving in, lows around 54, north-northwest, wind 6 to 11. And for tomorrow, again, look for a similar start. But cloudy skies through mid-morning, gradually clearing, and then high around 77, calm winds. And tomorrow night, it'll be clear, lows around 53, and a northwest wind, 5 to 10. Lovely, breezy spring evening. Alternative forecast, the new fruit moon in Aries is 27 days old. Synodic forecast, they say sow leafy vegetables and annuals that produce above ground. Also suggest is grains. You might want to try that. And it's a good time to pick vegetables if they are to be stored. The biodynamic forecast, moon in Aries, it's a fire sign. It's a good time for fruiting plants. And again, they say fruit harvested now will store longer. Don't have any fruit? Well, you will soon. Sidereal forecast, moon in Aries, dry and barren. And that's it for the alternative forecast as well as the conventional forecast. Moving right along, before we welcome Jeffrey Clements to the KBOO airwaves, we want to catch up with Jody McCaffrey. She is, of course, with Citizens Against LNG. We forget sometimes that we may have won a battle, but the major operation is certainly not over. Those out-of-state, offshore, private interests that have their baby little eyes fixed on the Oregon coast won't give up on the idea of LNG. And with the Trans-Pacific Partnership looming, and, of course, Obama, given his alarming track record on many of these fronts, is likely to sign that one. The prospect of LNG in the Oregon coast becomes ever more real as Portland and Salem begin to turn their backs on the issue, something we cannot afford to do at this juncture. We've come so far. It would be a tragedy to drop the ball now. Good morning, Jody. Thanks for being with us today.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Well, there is a letter out there, and I've signed it. My sons have signed it. Many other people have signed it. But yet, not enough people have signed it. And can you go over what the gist of that letter is and why it's so critical right now?
Well, it's really, it's a letter asking, it's actually addressed to Senator Wyden and Senator Merkley, and it's going to also be sent to the president. It's asking that they oppose LNG exports. There's debates going on right now and at the federal level on this issue because the Department of Energy has a large list of applicants that have applied to export LNG to non-free trade agreement nations, and they have to make a decision if that's in the public interest. So the public needs to be very much putting out the word that it's not in the interest of our nation as a whole for many reasons, because it increases pollution. Exporting will actually increase fracking, which is a very polluting process. And plus, it actually will raise the price of natural gas, and that can be very detrimental to all of gas consumers, including our manufacturers, who have actually been bringing jobs back to the United States because of our low energy costs.
It seems odd to me that coal, of course, another plague which we brought upon ourselves, has sort of expanded to occupy much of the attention span of many environmentalists, and we forget about this. There are so many other dangers that are associated with this. Can you let listeners know how they can get the deadline and where they can go to have a look at the letter and possibly add their names to those opposing LNG at Jordan Cove?
Well, actually, I could put the letter, I guess, up on our website. I was going to, like, get it in today, I was thinking, but people can add on to it or send a letter or send something in themselves. Right now, it's very critical because the president is going to be making some decisions on directing what the Department of Energy actually does. So I can actually put that up on the website. Our website's www.citizensagainstlng.com. Our people can just write just a short note to Senator Wyden, Senator Merkley, or the representatives, any of the federal people, including the president, and say and ask them to please not allow them to export.
This is our own. This is our own Keystone XL situation, and it's certainly, if people are concerned about the Keystone XL, we should be here in Cascadia. We should be at least as concerned about this. Jody, thanks so much for being back with us today, and we'll put a link to the website and the letter. If you could put it there, I imagine that it will attract more names. Thanks again for that. We're going to speak this morning also with Jeffrey Clements. The Ilihi Institute, since the fifth and final lecture of the 2013 series. The question under consideration this evening is, who owns our government? And it's a good question, isn't it? Not the usual 1% suspects. Perhaps a nameless, faceless, globalized corporate Aminos Gri. It's sort of a shadow casting a shadow of a shadow of a numbered account with no accountability whatsoever attached to it, apparently. Author and attorney Jeffrey Clements is, of course, as many listeners know, the co-founder of Free Speech for People. And he is also the author of Corporations Are Not People. Good morning, Jeffrey. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Hi, Chris. Glad to be here.
We're looking forward to, of course, the Ilihi lecture this evening. Can you talk a little bit about some of the key points that we should understand going in? We had Catherine Austin Fitz on a few weeks ago, and of course, she was one of the Ilihi lecturers, and she talked about the faceless global presence that is pushing us towards the corporatization of the government. And I wanted to ask you what that sort of an architecture might look like.
Well, you know, Chris, I think we're increasingly seeing the architecture all around us. And, you know, tonight I'm going to be talking about who owns our government. The Ilihi lecture series this year has been terrific about who owns you, who owns all of us. And in tonight's discussion, I think we're going to focus on the Citizens United case, which said corporations have the same rights as people, that there's no way the people are allowed to limit spending in elections. That would, according to the Supreme Court, violate the supposed rights of the largest corporations in the world and billionaires like Sheldon Adelson, who want to spend whatever they want to control our government. And, you know, my book really talks about where that came from. I think we all know this has been a long time coming, and it's been an increasing problem. But some of the numbers, I think, are extraordinary in terms of how much is spent to control what our government does, and more often, frankly, what our government doesn't do, which is why we don't see any action on things like climate change. We don't see any action on the things that actually affect the vast majority of Americans and people around the world, because our voice is no longer relevant to what the government's going to be doing.
It seems we've abdicated our role as citizens and engaged in communities, and we are now valued only as consumers. That, to me, would be a harbinger of the corporatization of our government.
I think we're seeing that. It's interesting that the Supreme Court actually uses words like marketplace to refer to what we used to think of as elections and speech and citizenship. And even the words that are being used by the court now and by those who have the dominant voice, in other words, those who control the largest corporations and what happens in our government, are using phrases that really have no place in a republic of free and equal people. Things like consumer, marketplace, rather than citizen and government of the people.
And it seems that we have indeed repurposed a great deal of our vocabulary, which has been very effective in directing the attention of the crowd. But we've rapidly run out of time here on Air Cascadia often, and I wondered if you could give us a sort of a synopsis of how would you want people to see the situation and going in? The lectures are great because there's audience participation. But can you summarize some of these ideas in a way that's a jumping off point for thinking more on the subject?
Yes, I think most people know the kind of situation we're in. I think most people know that the largest corporations and the richest tiny percentage of people are controlling most of what happens, not only in Washington, but across the country in state capitals. It's even coming to cities and towns, as Chevron has spent $1.2 million in a city council election in Richmond, California, $1.2 million in a community of of 100,000 people. So I think the question really is, what are we going to do about it? And that's what I will talk a lot tonight about the problem, but I also want to share what's happening across the country, and that's the Constitutional Amendment Campaign, Overturn Citizens United, Restore a Republic of Free and Equal People. And it's actually happening. 13 states have passed resolutions. It would be terrific if Oregon would join those states.
This will be it. This might be it. The proverbial tipping point. Thank you so much for that, my guest. It's been Jeffrey Clements. He'll be speaking this evening at the Ilihi Institute Lecture Series. This is a final lecture. And information on where and when will be on the website. This has been Air Cascadia for Wednesday, May 8th, 2013. Kurt Lowe engineered the show today. Thanks, Kurt. And Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Flashpoints, the death toll from the Bangladesh garment factory fire up to 717, and people are still being dug out of the rubble, hand over fist. We'll have a special report on that. Also, we'll hear from the United Nations what's been going on there in terms of who's using sarin gas against who. A lot going on about that. Meanwhile, the mainstream press is coming out full force. They want that war in Syria. Oh, it's different, they're saying, than the one in Iraq and the one in Afghanistan and the one in Vietnam and the, I could go on. Anyway, all this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have an in-depth discussion about the policies and the politics in terms of Syria. But we go again to the United Nations. We're joined by Matthew Russell Lee. He's a correspondent with Inner City News. He covers the United Nations. He's been working there over time. Matthew, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Sure. Thanks a lot. Glad to be here.
Well, it's good to have you with us. There's been, well, there were initial reports from one part of the United Nations, from one particular worker, Carla Del Ponte, saying that she had confirmation that some kind of confirmation, or it was strongly believed that sarin gas was being used by the rebels. Now, first of all, remind people of what that story exactly was, and then let's talk about the straighten this out, because there are two different folks from the UN looking into this at the moment.
Sure, definitely. And the one thing I'd say is that, you know, Carla Del Ponte, for what she's more than a worker, although of course she is a worker. She's been she was the prosecutor of the International Criminal Tribunal in Yugoslavia. She worked on the Rwanda Tribunal. So she's one of these sort of, you know, well-known people in the kind of human rights investigation field. I'm not saying that means she's always right by any means, but she's not. This wasn't like a kind of a whistleblower down the chain. She's one of three people named by the UN Human Rights Council to investigate the human rights situation in Syria. And I think that, in a way, I guess what I would read from this is that she may feel, I've actually, with the three panelists, before she joined the panel, one person quit and she was then named, have come through the UN here in New York. And I've always gotten a sense that they were very much, if not, I won't say beating the drums of war, but servicing the view of the conflict, that basically counting how many people Assad was killing and saying that something must be done, he must be referred to the International Criminal Court. And when I asked them, do they have any similar file on, say, the